It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, ancient remains of Native Americans were found on the planned site of a Kohler golf course. We'll talk about the disagreement around how the remains were treated and what's next for the site. First, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a little more than half of Americans have gotten at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 42% are fully vaccinated. People have reasons for not getting the shots. Among them is that they're worried about getting a surprise bill, even though the vaccine's free and available to all U.S. adults. A poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation showed that a third of unvaccinated adults didn't know whether insurance picked up the tab and were afraid they'd have to pay for it. A Kaiser researcher told the New York Times that that sentiment might reflect their experience with the wider health system, that, quote, people may have heard it's available for free, but not believe it. Our next guest says you can't blame him for being skeptical. He says America's healthcare system is, in a lot of ways, broken, and not just because of costs. We want to hear about your experiences, good, bad, otherwise, at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about surprise bills or unexpected costs when going to the doctor or having something done? Have you avoided healthcare at some point because you were worried about what you could end up being billed for? Are you happy with the quality of care you received? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Marty McCary is professor at the Johns Hopkins Schools of Medicine, Public Health, and Business. He's the chief medical advisor to Sesame Care and author of The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. The paperback version hit the shelves this week. It includes a new section on COVID-19. Dr. McCary, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Bill.
This is Rob. The survey I just mentioned, I imagine this doesn't come as a surprise to you, given what you've studied and written about in the healthcare system, that people might worry about getting the vaccine for fear that they're going to get a surprise bill down the road. What does that tell us?
Well, it's consistent with the data that we've seen in a survey that shows that 64% of Americans have avoided medical care or delayed it for fear of the bill. So it's affecting access. This new business model in healthcare of price gouging and predatory billing, going as far as suing patients in court to garnish their wages, even though they're insured and work and have came with good intentions, that represents the worst of modern medicine. And so we've got a national dashboard that we'll be putting up on Monday with Axios that will show how hospitals do on their billing quality, because medical billing quality is a form of medical quality, and financial toxicity is a medical complication.
I want to dig into a few of the stories you tell in the book. I was just reading up on one. You were visiting Carlsbad, New Mexico. You'd heard of a health agency there that was suing people, notorious for suing it, and you didn't even get to the people you wanted to talk to before you'd started hearing stories. Just almost everyone you ran into, it seems like, had a story about surprise billing, lawsuits, the courthouse saying, 95% or some of their cases from this one health agency. Tell us about that lawsuit side of the story, please.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's everyone's favorite chapter in the book, Chapter 3. So I just heard from a patient out there, because a lot of people who feel disenfranchised nationally have reached out to me. And I've heard of this case, and I thought, gosh, the hospital is suing her to garnish her wages. And these are Walmart workers and food service workers. You know, and it hit me. Most of America doesn't live like me. Most of America lives paycheck to paycheck. And for them, a $2,000 bill can be catastrophic. So I went to Carlsbad, New Mexico to visit and found that the person driving me from the airport had been sued by the hospital. The folks at the check-in at the hotel had been sued. This person I met with had been sued. I go to the courthouse. Some of the court clerks and the staff had been sued. I talked to the judge. The judge had been sued by the hospital for these crazy money games. And, you know, it's this old game of pointing the finger. Oh, it's in collection, so you have to talk to them, talk to your insurance company. And people are getting stuck in this Bermuda Triangle of money games. And it's not fair. It's not fair. And honestly, Rob, it's threatening the great public trust in American hospitals. I'm very proud of my profession as a doctor. But these kind of games are a disgrace to the great work that we do.
And you say in some cases it's easy to persuade hospital administrators. I think there was one here in Wisconsin, an Aurora system, where you brought these lawsuits to their attention and they stopped. Once you raise the issue, does it make a difference?
I was very impressed by the new CEO of the Aurora system. And basically in a conversation, I found him to be very reasonable, almost unaware that it was happening. You know, sometimes it gets outsourced through so many sub-departments. Hospital leaders, who are generally good people, they just don't realize how extensive this is and how ugly it looks on the ground. When I would go to court with people who had been sued by hospitals, and I still stand by my promise to defend anybody who has been sued by a hospital for a bill they could not afford, I will defend them as a pro bono expert. I'm not a lawyer, but I can argue. And we go to court and we defend these people and we win. My team and I win 100% of the time. And we've shut down the practice in most of the country. But we start off by simply asking the hospital to remember why we went into medicine and just beg them to stop this predatory practice.
Talking to Dr. Marty McCary, author of the book, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins. Dr. McCary, the cost, the surprise bills, that's part of the story you're telling. You're also worried about unnecessary treatment, over-medicalization of things that might be able to be treated without the kind of treatments we're using. What kind of things do you see?
We have the most medicalized, the most hospitalized, the most disabled, the most obese population in the history of the world. And we can talk about ways to cut the financial waste in healthcare, but ultimately we really have to get at what I call the appropriateness of care. And by the way, there's a massive movement right now by doctors and nurses and PAs and NPs to say, hey, let's start treating the whole person. And we can't do that in 10-minute visits when we've got a bill and code and you're burning us out. Physician burnout rates at all-time highs. This model is broken. So you see a lot of folks now scrapping it and starting to ask the really big questions on how to redesign care. And that is the most exciting thing happening right now in healthcare.
Can you talk about some of the efforts you've seen to redesign care, to make it look and feel and ultimately work different from what we might expect on that trip to the clinic?
Treating more patients with diabetes with cooking classes than just throwing insulin at them. We need to treat more back pain with ice and physical therapy than just surgery and opioids. We need to talk about school lunch programs instead of just talking about bariatric gastric bypass surgery in kids. We've got to talk about food as medicine. When we see somebody who has high blood pressure, we've got to start talking about their sleep patterns and how poor sleep can contribute to that high muscle tone in the blood vessels that causes high blood pressure. We should talk about sleep science and also stress management instead of just throwing antihypertensive meds at people. We can get at these underlying issues if you let us, if the system gets redesigned so we get off the treadmill of this billing throughput cycle. You know, the old model of healthcare is entirely broken, right? The system where you come into your doctor once a year and we say, eat better, exercise more, here's some pills. And then you come back in a year and we say, you bad, bad, non-compliant patient. That is a horrible system. Patients hate it. Doctors hate it. Why are we doing it? We've got to redesign it entirely because the hard part about chronic disease is not telling people what to do. It's helping them do it. And we can do that.
Yeah, how do you do that? Because I could see, I'm not a doctor, but if I was, I could see, you know, if I put these pills in this patient's hand, I think they can probably take one pill a day. If I'm asking them to make these fundamental lifestyle changes, I can't track that. I don't know if that prescription is going to be honored. How do we change our system to have that kind of follow-up?
So right now, doctors are sick of the traditional primary care system. And so what we're seeing them move to is a new model of care. And it goes by many different names, Iora, ChenMed, Landmark, Oak Street. They have these networks of dozens or hundreds of clinics where they're doing relationship-based care. And they don't just want to see you once a year or every few months. They want to love you. They want to create a community where you come in, you know folks, and you have a coach or you have a navigator there. It's not just the doc. You know, one doctor can't take care of a whole population. But if you partner that doctor with a nurse practitioner or a kinesiology major from college who's motivated to help navigate care for someone, we can give a team instructions and execute that plan. But it needs to be, we need to talk about a team approach. So we're seeing healthcare disrupted right now by these many clinics. Anyone over 65, pretty much in regions of the country now, can sign up for ChenMed or Iora or Oak Street or Landmark for free. And you get this incredible relationship-based care as a part of a Medicare Advantage plan. And also in other areas, it goes by direct primary care. For those with wealth, there's a version called concierge medicine now. And we're seeing care redesigned, and that's a good thing.
We're talking about the state of healthcare in the U.S. and what's being worked on to make it better with Dr. Marty McCary, professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Public Health, and Business. He's the author of the book, just coming out in paperback, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare, and How to Fix It. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences as a patient or provider at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about how to improve healthcare in the U.S. Dr. Marty McCary stays with us, professor at Johns Hopkins, author of the book, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. That book came out in paperback with a COVID-related update yesterday. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Jim is with us in River Falls. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And thank you so much, Dr. McCary, for all you've done to help patients throughout the United States. And I think I just read your book. I finished it a couple weeks ago and really impressed with what you're doing. A couple questions for you. First of all, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on a single payer system, because I know like in Britain and Canada, most people really like the healthcare system and they don't get stressed and have mental health issues after leaving the hospital because they're worried about going in debtor's prison to pay their bills. And then I really liked your story about the friend you had who was going to an elder network hospital in Baltimore there, and you told her to have them print out the admission papers and struck out all the language as far as you are required to pay for any of the services, you know, regardless of how overcharged they make the payments.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. So first of all, briefly, Dr. McCary, a single payer, and then feel free to elaborate on that story Jim raised.
Sure. Well, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate it. I don't rely on the government to fix healthcare. I don't think they're going to be able to do it. Each system has their pluses and minuses. And I think when you look at some of these systems, like a single payer system, which does have the attractiveness of kind of waste in the short term of a lot of the middlemen, it's one of the big pluses. Long term, generally speaking, countries universally underfund their healthcare systems. Go 10 or 20 years into that system, and there's across-the-board cuts that create almost a dilapidated system. Matter of fact, Medicare may very well be that right now. The Medicare reimbursement rates are low, and they're going down each year. On going to the hospital, look, if you have to go to the emergency room, this was a fun story in the book, and they tell you, hey, you got to sign this financial form. Don't sign it, okay? Unless they give you prices and tell you exactly what you're going to be responsible for, you don't sign that. And if they tell you you have to sign it, go ahead and sign it. Did not read on the signature line, because it's unfair for them to throw you this document that says you will commit to signing your car, life, home, and mortgage completely over to the hospital under penalty of law for some bill that you have not seen and they don't have the courtesy to give you an estimate of. So that is a tip that I've given people. And when we go to court, we tell the judges, look, this patient's happy to pay the bills. Just show us the agreement where they said they would pay it. There's under contract law, there's no agreement.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jim. We'll go to Kate now in Madison. Kate, hi.
Hi there. My name's Kate. I'm an occupational therapy student at UW-Madison right now. And when you talked about, you know, bringing maybe a kinesiology student in to help out with this team, my thought was occupational therapy, that's what we do. We help with lifestyle change. So you could have a patient or a client come in and their PCP or their doctor says, you know, you can do X, Y, and Z to help with this, you could have OTs follow up on these lifestyle changes as part of the team.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kate.
I mean, this is what we're talking about.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is the team-based approach, Rob, that we need right now. And this is what we can build. You know, this idea of, hey, we're going to send you to this person and go across the street and drive, you know, 10 miles and go get an appointment with this specialist. These new modern clinics have it all in-house, and it's coordinated. And it's not with just a physician. It's with every aspect of the medical team, and the results are pretty darn impressive. So I appreciate Kate's call.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Dr. Marty McCary, author of the book, The Price We Pay on the American Healthcare System. Well, we've got you here, Dr. McCary. Last time we talked to you about COVID-19. There was some good news by the time we talked to you, more good news right now, it seems like, especially compared to where we were as a nation, say, in January. Can you talk about what you're seeing in the latest trends?
Well, first of all, I think we always have to be humble to recognize that things could change in a way that were unexpected. But we're doing really good right now. We have, compared to the number of daily flu cases in the middle of the mildest flu season of the last 8 years, we have about 1/50th the number of COVID cases as flu in the mildest flu season, in the middle of that mild flu season. That is, we've had about 14,000 cases a day, most asymptomatic, picked up on screening. And in a mild flu season, we'll have 400,000 to 450,000 cases a day. About 80 to 85% of the adults in the United States are immune. And instead of talking about the vaccinated and unvaccinated, we should really talk about the immune and non-immune, as I described in yesterday's Wall Street Journal in a piece titled The Power of Natural Immunity, and that's from prior infection. New research now from Cleveland Clinic, Washington University, and other places are showing natural immunity is pretty darn good, and as good and maybe even more long-lasting and durable than vaccinated immunity. We'll see. But if you have natural immunity, I think you can bank on it based on the best available data.
Now, one of the Cleveland Clinic authors of that study was quoted in a TV story saying, we're not saying don't get the vaccine, even to people who already have that natural immunity. And I know we're going to be measuring how long immunity lasts from vaccines and natural and so on. I don't know. What do you make of the recommendations that even if you've had COVID, should you still get the vaccine?
Look, the reason he said that is because he's got a gun to his head by the medical establishment that's just saying, look, you can veer off the path, but don't go too far off. The data that they published showed that among those with natural immunity who got a vaccine, the vaccine provided no added benefit. So, look, I also tell people when they say, hey, I had COVID, should I get the vaccine? I'll often say, sure, but I would get just one dose. Or if you choose not to, you're probably completely fine based on the best available data. There's more data on natural immunity than vaccinated immunity because natural immunity has been around longer, and I think we can trust it.
The big message, though, I guess, is if you don't have natural immunity and you haven't gotten vaccinated, is that where a lot of our attention should be right now?
Yeah, it's those who are still non-immune, those who are susceptible. And there's a bunch of those folks. Now, some of them had the infection and were asymptomatic, so they're immune without realizing it. But that's where we really need to promote our efforts. And look, we can run commercials by politicians, and I know they're going to be doing that in Wisconsin. But what we really need to do is stop with the celebrity begging and instead just make vaccines more accessible at routine points of care in American life. You come out of the grocery store and somebody says, hey, do you have 5 minutes to get vaccinated for COVID-19? That's how we're going to increase our vaccination rates. And by the way, we don't have to get 100%. We're doing pretty good because 64% of adults have been vaccinated. And of the other 36% who haven't, half have natural immunity from prior infection based on the studies I described in yesterday's Wall Street Journal.
Just a minute and a half or so left, Dr. McCary. You wrote the bulk of this book before COVID-19. You've updated a little bit now. Is there a lesson we should be taking from COVID-19 to inform how we want to fix our healthcare system?
Well, look, if we learn the lessons and apply them properly, we could see major advances in science like we've never seen in the last 50 years. And that's because we saw the mRNA technology, which, by the way, has been around since the 1990s. But we saw some real attention focused on how to do this properly and well. in a way that we could do it for everyone in the world and apply the vaccine broadly, so set high safety standards. Why don't we do that for HIV? We should have an HIV vaccine next year and some types of cancer. Vaccines have been shown to work for cancer with melanoma. And how about we start tackling Alzheimer's by looking at the underlying causes, not just the drugs to treat it after it develops? If we apply the same scientific rigor and speed and agility of our $3 trillion healthcare system to fixing problems quickly like this, we can see major advancements in the next few years. And that's exactly what we need to be doing.
Dr. McCary, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
It's Dr. Marty McCary, professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Public Health and Business. He's also the author of the book, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. That came out in paperback this week. It includes a new section on COVID. You can continue the conversation, by the way, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. A number of you have weighed in with your healthcare experiences. We heard from Brandy, who wrote, "When I lived in Northeast Wisconsin, never had to wait long for an appointment. Living in Southeast Wisconsin, I've had to wait a month or more to meet a specialist. Other than that, my healthcare experience has been very good. On the other hand, the cost of healthcare is ridiculous." Joel says, "In general, my healthcare has been excellent. The only thing I would change would be more face-to-face involvement with the physician, less with the nurse practitioner and or physician's assistant." And Dahl says, "The actual care is fine, but the lack of transparency in billing and the greed of the insurance companies is a major problem." Dahl says, "Even if you have money, it's impossible to predict how much a procedure will cost until you get the bill. Even if you get an estimate, it can be wildly inaccurate. We need," Dahl says, "Medicare for all." Well, what do you think? Do you have an experience to share or an idea to share when it comes to American healthcare? An experience maybe as a patient or a provider yourself? Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think and what you've seen there. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about controversy around a proposed Kohler Company golf course near Kohler Andre State Park after ancient Native American remains were uncovered on that site. We'll check out new reporting on that issue from Wisconsin Watch and the wider issues it raises. By the way, coming up tomorrow on Central Time on Food Friday, cooking doesn't have to be stressful. Shouldn't be stressful. Our guest says, hey, we can make cooking healthy and easy and calming and fun all at the same time. And we'll get some recipes to help us do just that. And you can let us know, tweet us at Central Time WPR. What is your comfort cooking recipe and your favorite style of cooking when you need to keep calm? And maybe keep cool, not thinking about turning the oven on today. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, teens are hitting summer vacation after a weird year. Find out about the prospects for summer jobs, trips, and more. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Wisconsin-based Kohler Company plans to build their third championship golf course in the state on land next to the Kohler Andre State Park. A UW-Milwaukee archaeology team performing a required study of the land in 2018 and 19, funded by Kohler, encountered fragments of human bones and teeth, later identified as belonging to early Native Americans. Wisconsin is home to the most burial sites in North America, according to the DNR. This is just one instance of the challenges of balancing cultural sensitivities and needs and property rights in the state. You could join in at 800-642-1234. In instances where a piece of Native American history is found like this, and Native American remains in particular, how do you think it should be handled? What's the right way, a culturally sensitive way to approach this? Do you have issues like this in your part of the state? Have you been following this particular story? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Casey Keeler is Tuolumne Miwok and citizen Potawatomi. She's an assistant professor of American Indian Studies and holds an appointment in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Casey, welcome to Central Time. And Jim Malowitz is, Jim Malowitz is the investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. He wrote the piece Ancient Human Remains Unearthed at the Proposed Golf Course Site in Wisconsin. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your piece, Jim. What exactly was found by this UW-Milwaukee archaeology team, and why were they in the first place?
Sure. Well, as you summarized at the top, they found fragments of bone and as well as teeth, human teeth that date back potentially as far as 2,500 years ago. And these were during excavations in Sheboygan County at the site where Kohler is planning its proposed golf course. And so these were not necessarily, what you would typically consider, I guess a sort of more marked burial sites. I mean, these have been sites that have been sitting there for thousands and thousands of years. But these were the remains of folks that were disturbed after all of those years. And the archaeologists who found them at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee believe, of course, that these belong to indigenous people who lived and worked lived at the site all that time ago.
And Casey, are there laws in place dealing with when you find artifacts or especially remains on a potential development site like this?
Right, absolutely. I would say most folks, in terms of thinking about human remains, native human remains, are more familiar with NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And that came about in 1990, but that's specific to certain institutions. And in this case, does not apply because the lands are privately owned by Kohler.
So are there any, I guess, legal protections or legal laws that apply here to a privately owned site where remains like this are found?
Right. So Wisconsin does have a burial law that adheres in this specific case. And it can be a bit murky in terms of what actually happens to the remains once they're discovered. The process as it unfolds is a bit complicated. And in this situation in particular, determining who the descendants of those remains are, because at this area in Wisconsin, Sheboygan County, they are kind of the traditional homelands of both the Menominee and the Potawatomi people. So it gets into this really complicated process of figuring out who are these remains related to in terms of ancestors and tribal affiliation as well.
And Jim, can you give us a little backstory on this proposed golf course development on this site?
Sure. Well, it's a backstory with many twists and turns. So the Kohler Company has been pushing to put this golf course here on this 247-acre site for years. And it's been a controversial plan. It's got a lot of pushback, most vocally from some environmentalists and also local folks who live near the site. There have been many, there's been much litigation surrounding the site. Particularly around the DNR's decision to grant Kohler a permit to fill wetlands and also a challenge of a decision by the DNR to do a land swap with Kohler in which Kohler was able to gain parts of Kohler Andre State Park for part of the site in exchange for some other land. So that's been litigated as well. And also this this golf course was originally located in the town of Wilson, and there was also litigation surrounding that when there was questions about whether the town would actually allow the course to go forward and grant permits. Kohler came up with a plan with the city of Sheboygan to annex that land, and Sheboygan now has jurisdiction. So there's a very long story there.
And Casey, I had asked you earlier about legal issues when it comes to Native American remains on a site like this. Can you talk about just issues of respect? Comparisons, I think, have been made to, okay, what if we were doing a golf course, say, at a cemetery down the street or something like that? What kind of issues leap to your mind there?
Right, absolutely. And that was brought up in Jim's article as well. So I think this is a good reminder of the history of Indigenous dispossession across what is present day Wisconsin and across the entirety of North America in general. So, you know, I teach classes at the University of Wisconsin, and I'm always amazed at how little students in the general public know about tribal nations of Wisconsin. So again, this is a good reminder to think about folks who have lived in these areas before us and what is our responsibility as people who now inhabit these areas to those who came before us. And in many cases, as in the case of the Kohler Golf Course and the discovery of these human remains, we don't always know what is under the earth that we live on today. And then once those discoveries are made, what is the responsible and culturally respectful things to do? And I think part of what complicates this is that American Indians have so long been portrayed as in the past and romanticized as living beings throughout the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. And we don't have that sort of visibility and awareness that carries through to the 20th and 21st centuries. So many people just think, you know, these Native remains, they're, you know, thousands of years old. And why does that matter today? But it absolutely does. And that's something that really gets lost sight of, the living and direct ancestors of these people.
Talking to Casey Keeler, Assistant Professor of American Indian Studies at UW-Madison, and Jim Malowitz, Investigations Editor at Wisconsin Watch, looking at a story about the proposed Kohler Golf Course, what would be the newest one, and remains, artifacts, and bodily remains of Native Americans found on the site. You can join in with your thoughts on the issue, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jim, I understand there's a group of mounds on the 247-acre site that Kohler has said will be left untouched and open to the public to see. Could you talk about that part of the story?
Sure. And Kohler has said that it has plans, to allow public access to those mounds. I asked but didn't get an answer on precisely how many mounds those are. But Kohler does say that it's not designing the course to abut those mounds, that these mounds would be outside of the actual field of play.
And Jim, also, there had been concerns about how human remains disturbed at the Kohler site have been handled since they were found. Can you share that part of the story?
Sure. And I would also be interested in some of Casey's perspective on this. But that was something that I learned a whole lot about state burial law and just archaeology in general while reporting this. There's an interesting tension here between not only the Kohler company and what it plans to do the idea of putting a golf course on this burial site, but also over the process of archaeology itself in disturbing these remains. In this case, we have tribal historic preservation officers in the area who were monitoring this excavation, and this excavation only took place because of a federal preservation law. This site is eligible by all accounts for the National Register of Historic Places, and therefore Kohler is required to go forward with a plan to study the area for educational purposes, because the federal preservation law requires Kohler or developers who are going to disturb this historic land to mitigate the damage they're doing to that historic land. So in this case, the plan is to do education. And so that's why Kohler ended up contracting University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to do this excavation to see what's below the land. And, you know, beyond the indigenous people's remains, UW-Milwaukee also found a trove of various artifacts that might reveal more about how people lived in the land as well. So through this educational process, these remains were disturbed. Some of the tribal historic preservation officers, including Bill Quackenbush, who was the one who chatted with me, who is a Ho-Chunk officer, were disturbed at some point and talked about this tension over how archaeologists often, might treat these remains kind of more as artifacts versus, actual ancestors of people who are, living today.
And Casey, I did want to get your thoughts on that.
Right. It's so interesting to hear, how different folks talk about the remains that are discovered. I would say for Native folks, these are ancestors, which today's Native people are descendants of, rather than artifacts, something to be cataloged and housed in a museum or other institution. And I think a way to think about this is, how would you like to see the remains of your ancestors being treated, right? Most people would be appalled to know that their ancestors several generations back, if their remains were being dug up and cataloged and housed and studied by a museum, right? Most folks would like to see the remains of their ancestors reinterred, reburied with proper ceremony. So again, there's this discrepancy that we often see with Native remains in particular and how they have been studied. There's this really long history of studying Native people and Native remains in particular, somehow distinct and different.
We're talking to Jim Malowitz, investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch, and Casey Keeler, assistant professor of American Indian Studies with an appointment in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, looking at the unearthing of ancient Native American remains at the future site, a proposed site of a Kohler Company golf course. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Casey Keeler. She teaches in American Indian Studies and at the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Also with us, Jim Malowitz, investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch, talking about reporting on the ancient remains of Native Americans found when studying the future site of a Kohler golf course here in the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Sandy is with us in Williams Bay. Sandy, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Sandy?
Well, I have been heading up a group trying to save a piece of land in Lake Geneva, on Lake Geneva in Williams Bay. It's an old-growth oak forest that's never been disturbed, and we know the Potawatomi lived there until they were removed in the late 19th century. And they're, kind of been, it's about 40 acres that's been systematically sort of sold off for private development. And we did get them to do a survey of about 10 acres, and it was a phase one. So it's a sort of a superficial, I understand, archaeological study. But we're really trying to get them to do all of it because the fact that it's land that's undisturbed, never been developed, and never been there's never been any study of it for archaeological remains or artifacts. And I'm pretty certain, looking at documentation from the early part of last century, that we know the Indians all lived in that area, the Potawatomi, Native American Indians. So we just I'm not sure what resources there are. And if people aren't interested in it, it's very hard to, get local people involved and governments involved in having an interest in that. I think it's very important, and it would be exciting.
Gotcha. Sandy, thanks for calling in. Casey, do you have thoughts on Sandy's story?
I do think that there's opportunity for collaboration between tribal nations and local community residents or activists, environmental activists in particular, around the preservation of such sites. But as we know, this can often be a large expense to hire appropriate people to come in and do the surveying work. And then, of course, we increasingly see challenges and conflicts between private property owners and land developers and those working to preserve specific sites as well. So, even if there was some sort of collaboration between private citizens who live in the area and tribal communities, you know, then what happens in terms of paying the bills and what to do if such remains were found. So thinking about whose land, who owns that land right now, and also figuring out the descendants of the Native communities who would have been occupying that land as well. The caller mentioned the removal of Potawatomi, which happened across the region. So there's often difficulty in bringing those community members back and having them play a more substantial role in the recovery or even the surveying of particular pieces of land as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Jim, that reminds me, I wanted to ask you, are there plans for more surveys, follow-up surveys on the proposed Kohler Golf Course site?
So right now there's still inventorying going on. And so there aren't plans, as far as I understand from my reporting, to do further excavation. But right now the UW-Milwaukee team is analyzing the, again, thousands and thousands of artifacts, you know, including pottery and, you know, things like that, that were found. And this is a process that it sounds like it's going to take several years, according to the Wisconsin Historic Society, whose state archaeologist is also involved in this process. So it's going to be a long process that is one of many hurdles that could delay this golf course.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chris is with us in Darlington. Chris, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. And I want to say this is a fascinating topic. I'll make a point real quick. When I was a kid, and this takes back 60 years ago, I was wrestling with a friend and we kicked up some artifacts. And these Indian artifacts, I believe they were Native American artifacts, were from the Southwest. And I have had them for over the many years, and I contacted the anthropology department at UW-Madison, and they were not interested because they said there's no way that these artifacts that had Aztec markings on them would ever come up this far. And I think that, in fact, the Native Americans had much greater sophistication with commerce, that they came up through the Mississippi and through the Wisconsin River. And my question is there anyone I could talk to? I would like to get these artifacts into their rightful owner. And it's something that I've had for many years, and I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Chris, thanks for the call. A unique story there, Casey. But in general, for people who find what they think are artifacts and want to, as Chris said, get them back into the right hands, where do they start?
Right. I think, as the caller mentioned, you know, he reached out to the UW-Madison Archaeology Anthropology Department, and I would say that is a good resource. I don't know in particular who he contacted or at what point, but that is a good resource. UW-Milwaukee, as Jim has reported on in his news story, also the Wisconsin Historical Society. But you also have to understand that these places are receiving numerous requests for such assistance in finding artifacts as well. So there is like a lot of labor involved and just the monetary amount. So it can be, you know, a tiresome process that does take some time as well. So I suppose if you don't get the response that you're looking for or hearing or want to hear, then just try again.
Thanks for that call. And Jim, in just our last few moments, this is a long-term complicated process with this golf course and the surveys and everything. What are you watching for next as we wrap up?
I'm definitely watching for what's going to happen in the courts. On the one hand, I'm awaiting the results from the UWM team as they do some more analysis and to see what their report looks like, which, you know, could take another year or two. But also we have litigation that's ongoing as well. There was a judge in Sheboygan County just earlier this month who said that the DNR illegally granted Kohler the wetlands permit or that the cited on behalf of the challengers. So I'll be watching all that litigation And I'll also be interested too to see how the landscape changes as well. We have rapidly fluctuating lake levels that
and we'll,
the site
we'll
on
have to
lake
leave
Michigan.
It there. We're all out of time. Thanks to both of our guests, Jim Malowitz with Wisconsin Watch and Casey Keeler, Assistant Professor of American Indian Studies at UW-Madison, joining us for a look at the Kohler proposed golf site. You can find a link to Jim's article, WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow, Food Friday, turn up the stove, but turn down the stress. Easy, stress-free recipes, that and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. July 4th is just a few weeks off. That's often a big time to visit the Statue of Liberty in New York. And visitors this year will get an extra bonus, a second Statue of Liberty. As reported by CNN, France, which provided the original one, is sending a new, smaller statue nicknamed the Little Sister. The bronze statue is 1/16th the size of the original. The idea for the first statue came at the end of the Civil War. It was given by France in celebration of the end of slavery. The new one also honors the ending of slavery, and it had a dedication ceremony in France on the anniversary of the D-Day landing. The statue will be set up on Ellis Island in early July before going to its permanent home in Washington, D.C. I visited the Statue of Liberty, the big one, on a family trip a few years back. It was really worth the visit. There were some really long lines. So one memory, there was a street entertainer working the crowd, captive audience, we're all in line. Can't remember what entertaining he did, but in chatting with him, he was able to name a surprising number of Wisconsin cities, more than the average New Yorker, I think. My one big piece of tourist attraction advice, if you make the trip to New York, if you want to see a view from a big, tall building, go up in the Rockefeller Center building. There's like no line. Empire State Building, man, oh man, hours and hours to get up there with basically the same view. Tourist news you can use. This is Central Time.